Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, African nations get on board as world leaders move to protect biodiversity.
The African states directly, for the first time, gave an okay that they want to enlarge their financial engagement. They have understood that biodiversity and poverty alleviation have to be thought together and have to be implemented.
The race is on. Energy giants are looking for more ways to tap the Arctic for oil.
It was almost eerie how much open water we saw because of the massive retreat of ice. We were at 80 degrees north.
And we buzz into the German capital to meet some quirky beekeepers.
It is hip, I think. In the last 2 years, we have seen that some beekeepers put their bee families on the roofs.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. We start this week in the Indian city of Hyderabad, where the United Nations held a major conference on biodiversity last week. Policymakers, conservationists, scientists, and civil society groups gathered together to confront the challenges of saving the world's biodiversity. But what does biodiversity mean? Well, it can refer to all the different kinds of living organisms, a towering redwood tree, a sleepy koala, even a pesky bacterial colony. But here's the key. The world's plants and animals are interconnected. They depend on each other. A tree stand shelters animals, the animals eat plants, the plants need rich, healthy soil to grow and bees to help them pollinate. As biodiversity is lost, these connections weaken and every life form in the chain is affected. Food sources are lost. Plants used for medicine are lost. Economic opportunities shrink. So that's why delegates from more than 190 nations gathered in India for the talks. Their goal? To ensure the survival of diverse species and ecosystems threatened by pollution, exploitation, and habitat loss. And our reporter, Andre Leslie, kept an eye on the conference for us. He joins me now here in studio. Andre, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Saroja. Hello.
Now, things seem to have ended on a positive note with a broad agreement from several nations to contribute funds towards the protection of the world's biodiversity. What kind of spending are we talking about here?
Well, the money that we're talking about is 7.7 billion euros. Which sounds like a lot, obviously. Some experts have said it should actually be more like 300 billion. So it's a big number, but it perhaps there's room for it to improve. Most specifically, the developed countries here have said that they want to double their funding towards helping the developing nations reach the biodiversity targets set down in 2010, the so-called Aichi targets from Japan. And they'll be doing that by 2015.
Now, there were more than 190 nations at the table. Did any one country stand out?
Well, they all have promised to substantially lift their domestic spending. So that's a thing that everyone agreed upon. They all agreed upon lifting domestic spending onto biodiversity. I think it was interesting to see that there was a real change of speed from African nations who up until then had been reluctant to come to the table on biodiversity. I actually spoke to Ulrich Stöcker from the German Environment Aid Organization, and he had a bit more to say about that.
The African states directly, for the first time, gave an okay that they want to enlarge their financial engagement. They have understood that biodiversity and poverty alleviation have to be thought together and have to be implemented together. And without their natural resources, they don't have any chance for a sustainable, a good future.
Now, not everyone was behind the drive to gain more funding for the protection of biodiversity.
Yeah, it seems actually that some industrialized nations really are dragging the chain here a bit. In fact, your native Canada was seen as a bit of a dark horse here.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a poor performer at the table. They seemed to be reluctant to agree to extra biodiversity funding, and they didn't want to talk about questions of ecosystem restoration.
Yeah, the Canadian government has come under fire this year for failing to keep pace with the rest of the world when it comes to environmental policy.
Yeah, Japan was also reluctant, so it wasn't just Canada. Japan was actually chairman of the convention for the last 2 years, but since the last discussions in Nagoya, obviously there was the Fukushima nuclear incident, and that has meant that they've had to move a lot of their spending onto problems to do with Fukushima, and they were unwilling really to talk about further biodiversity or environmental protection spending.
I was reading an interesting article that came out around the time of the biodiversity conference about vulture activists who were in Hyderabad for the conference. Apparently, in South Asia, the population of flesh-eating birds has dropped 99%. The reason that this is happening is because the cattle are full of veterinary drugs, and that's not something that the vultures can eat. So they leave the corpses of the cattle in the fields, the corpses start to rot, and that ends up in the water system. So we can see there a lot of the connection between the failure to support biodiversity and the effect on us as human beings. Can you tell me about some of the other findings presented at the conference?
Well, you talk about a drop in number of birds there. There was an amazing statistic brought out by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. We reported about it on our website. 400 animals they've added to the red list, which is sort of highly endangered animal list. That's 400 animals since June, since the Rio Plus 20. So that's how quickly it's
really
moving forward.
Yeah, rapid loss.
They actually said there are a couple of animals. I think a small snail was amongst them who has now just disappeared. They are now extinct. There were also, I should report, a few other things that pushed ahead during the conference. Marine biodiversity. There was a lot of discussions on protecting new areas of marine environments, Sargasso Sea in the North Atlantic, the Tonga Archipelago, and some coral sites off the coast of Brazil. They were all agreed upon as being important sites to protect. And there was a really interesting meeting of city mayors who came together to talk about biodiversity on a local level, which I found really interesting. It's one of many side events that took place during the meeting. I spoke to David Ainsworth from the Convention on Biological Diversity in Montreal about this.
This summit brought together mayors from all over the world, and they were exchanging experiences on how they did their own biodiversity strategies and action plans, and how they're going to move forward and actually achieve the Aichi targets themselves. That's extremely significant because for all the commitments we have at the national level, we know now that conservation work at the local level is where it's at.
Now that's interesting. Local politicians trying to create global change. That sounds like something pretty positive.
Yeah, it is. Look, I think the whole feeling about this conference coming out the back of it, they really stayed in there till early on Saturday morning, making sure they got this funding agreement finalised. I think the general feeling was really positive. You really got a feeling that there were actions being taken, there were promises being made, and not just words and discussions floating about the room. There were some complaints, though, from environmental NGOs who went along as observers, as you might expect. I spoke to Ariba Hamid. She's a senior campaigner from Greenpeace, and she said there were some aspects of the conference that could have been done better.
It was pointed out by various civil society members that there wasn't enough community participation. There were representatives of various communities, whether it's the fishermen community or the coastal communities or forest dweller rights, but there weren't enough of them personally present there to be able to make their point. And the fact that it's a closed-door conference and the fact that all the negotiations happen in English, and for example, there is no translation in regional languages. So I think that was one of the things.
Now, the delegates have returned home, but the talks are over for now, but the conversation continues. Can you tell us a little bit about what we can expect in the future?
Well, India is now chairman of this UN Convention on Biological Diversity for the next 2 years. So India will play the leading role here, which is interesting because Ariba Hamid there, herself from India, that we just heard, she's concerned that India really isn't doing enough on its own doorstep, for instance, doing coal mining in areas of forest of important forests in India. So it'll be interesting to see whether India actually really does make an effort itself. And most importantly, I think it's in 2014, when they meet again together in South Korea, the funding levels that they've promised to now will be checked again. So that's the important next moment.
Thanks for that, Andre.
No problem, Saraja.
Andre Leslie there, giving us a wrap-up of the Biodiversity Conference that finished in southern India last week. Andre is the newest member of the environment team here at DW, so we'll be hearing a lot more from him. Now, we'll be joined shortly by a woman who was actually from Hyderabad. She's here in Germany to study environmental reporting and will tell us about her experience. But first, a quick cut of music from one of my favorites. Here's the Asian Dub Foundation. Asian Dub Foundation there with New Way, New Life. I have another visitor here with me in studio today. Sarah Abraham is a journalist from India. She's come all the way to Germany to learn about environmental journalism. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, you're participating in a program called Grow Green India here at DW. Can you tell me a little bit about what you've been doing?
We have been here for about 2 months, almost 2 months now, and for the first month we were trained in multimedia. After that, we started working on our stories, which was the most fun part. We have been learning so much about environment and environmental policies and alternate energy and sustainable lifestyle here in Germany, so our stories are based on that.
So what was the most interesting story you got to work on while you've been here?
They've all been interesting, but the most interesting one was on sustainable condoms.
Okay, now tell me a little bit about that.
Well, they use fair trade rubber from India, actually, from a rubber plantation called New Ambadi in India to make the condoms, which means that fair wages, the emissions are cut down drastically. So Condomi does those condoms.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about your own home in India? There you wrote about a festival once, and it was about idols of the god Ganesha being dunked into water, and that was creating something of an environmental hazard.
Yes.
I'm really curious about this story. What was that about?
We have a festival called Ganesh Chaturthi in India. Ganesha is our god with the elephant head. He is the imperfect god of perfection. So he is supposed to bring you good luck and wisdom and intelligence and knowledge. So we have this festival where we create idols of Ganesha, and he is worshipped for about 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, his idols are taken and immersed in water. But the problem is that a lot of these idols are made from plaster of Paris and toxic paints are used, which causes a lot of environmental pollution, obviously, when you dunk it in water. In Hyderabad, it's dunked in a man-made lake called Hussein Sagar Lake. And a few organizations pointed out that it's causing a lot of problems. So a few organizations, again, try to prevent this. But it's a religious thing. You can't stop it. So what they finally came up with was they started making idols out of clay, which does not cause environmental problems and it does not cause water pollution. And they started using non-toxic paints. So we were trying to build awareness about the alternate kind of idols that you can use so you can still worship your god and have a festival and celebrate, but without causing any damage. So that was a very interesting story that I did.
Now, what do you think as a up-and-coming environmental journalist? What do you think your role is when you go home? What can you do to help protect the planet?
I want to make green lifestyle not just a choice. I want to make it a habit. The attitude has to change. I mean, if you can take the bus to work, take the bus to work, don't drive. If you can walk, walk. If you can get a cycle, cycle, do that. Just make those little changes every day. That means that the way you think has to change, the way you act has to change. So the entire attitude needs to shift from what is easiest for me to what I should responsibly do. And that can only happen if you talk about it, if you write about it and people read about it and realize that it's not that difficult to make these small changes.
The middle class in India is growing very, very quickly. People have a better standard of living probably than, at least in our lifetime, there hasn't been this kind of rapid growth of the middle class. And that means opportunity. It means more ability to buy things. In the middle of all of that, do you see an opportunity for creating a better future? And do you think that that's really something that we can imagine for India in the future?
We don't have a choice. We have to. There won't be a planet left if we don't do it. So we have to do that. When we buy something, we have to think about the impact that the product has had on the environment. We have to consider if it's been ethical. It can't always be about the cheapest product. It has to be about the responsible, ethical product as well. So we need to create that awareness. We have to.
Sarah Abraham has been participating in a program here at DW called Grow Green India, which trains environmental journalists and sends them back home with the hopes of producing interesting stories. Sarah, I hope we'll hear from you in the future. Thanks very much for joining us on Living Planet.
Thank you.
It's time now for our roundup of other environment stories making the headlines this week. Here's Connor Dillon with the Eco News.
At a Hong Kong container port, officials seized ivory tusks and illicit ornaments worth a record 2.6 million euros, or $3.45 million. The articles were being smuggled from Africa to Hong Kong. The 1,209 ivory tusks weighed in at 3.8 tons. Officially, they were declared as plastic scrap, the government said. Hong Kong is not a major center for this kind of illegal ivory smuggling. It is an isolated incident. The shipment was not destined for Hong Kong, but was intercepted on its route. The ivory cost the lives of 600 African elephants. Work is underway once more on the massive Belo Monte Dam near the Amazon River in Brazil. It comes after the public consortium reached a deal with indigenous groups and fishermen who had occupied one of its building sites. Norte Energia, the consortium building the hydroelectric dam, had apparently reached a deal with the 150 protesters who had occupied Pimentel, one of five construction sites on October 8th. The protesters accused the consortium of failing to live up to promises made in June to build schools, homes, and a hospital. Indigenous groups fear the dam, which cuts across the Xingu River, a tributary of the Amazon, will harm their way of life. Environmentalists have also warned of deforestation and damage to the local ecosystem. Tequila. It's Mexico's signature drink and is known the world over. Now, residual biomass derived from the agave plant, which is used to make tequila, is also being employed to produce fuel. The project is being carried out by a company called Carbon Diversion America Latina in the Mexican western state of Jalisco and aims to produce renewable fuel to replace fossil fuel, diesel 9 or bunker fuel in this case, used in industrial furnaces and boilers. It takes 2.1 kilos, or 4.6 pounds, of agave briquettes to match 1 liter of bunker fuel. Francisco Villasenor, who runs the company, says the clients of his who use agave briquettes are saving 25% when compared to bunker fuel. Scientists at the National Marine Mammal Foundation in San Diego, California, released audio that they claim shows a beluga whale spontaneously mimicking sounds of the human voice. The foundation, which published its findings in the scientific journal Current Biology, released a still photograph and an audio recording of a white whale's speech. The foundation's president, Dr. Sam Ridgway, said the vocalizations from the whale named Nock sounded like two people speaking. The conversations, he claimed, were heard several times before the whale was eventually identified as the source. In fact, they discovered the sounds when a diver mistook the whale for a human voice giving him underwater directions.
That was Connor Dillon with the Eco News. We're traveling now to the German capital where beehives are flourishing. Private ones, run by hobby beekeepers. Across Berlin, you can find hives tucked into small balconies and installed in community gardens. And beekeeping classes are filling up quickly. In our next report, DW correspondent Charlotte Lomas learned a little more about urban beekeepers who are creating a buzz.
Wandering around the city of Berlin, one doesn't get the impression it would be an ideal spot for harvesting bees and their honey. Yet with more than 500 beekeepers in the German capital, there's never a swarm too far away. But urban beekeeping in Berlin is hardly new. In fact, it has a long history. Here, the practice has traditionally increased in times of economic hardship. If anyone knows the industry, it's Evelyn Jesse, who grew up in East Germany. She started one of the first beekeeping supply shops in Berlin in 1990, following Germany's reunification. For the past 23 years, Evelyn has watched the industry wax and wane.
It's a season business. We are so busy in the time from May up to August, and then we have silence. But in the last 2 years, we see it. Is it more? Our daughter and I, we are so busy, and in past, it was okay for me alone.
While Evelyn long managed the shop alone, she attributes the recent increase in business to the growing popularity of beekeeping around the world.
It is hip, I think. In the last 2 years, we have seen that some beekeepers are put their bee families on the roofs. I think there were some TV reportage from New York and other cities, and it was crazy to see that in New York, a bee is on the roof of Manhattan also. And this was the reason for some people to say, oh, the same thing we can make in Berlin.
The beekeeping boom has certainly been felt by beekeeper Heinz Risser, who, because of repeated requests, started offering beekeeping courses in the Princess Innengarten. Here, in an urban garden next to a busy traffic intersection, in the middle of the Kreuzberg district, Heinz teaches people how to care for bees and harvest their honey.
Normalerweise tut der Imker die Bienen in so kleine Kisten und
Heinz has been beekeeping for the past 40 years, learning from his father at the age of 9. He now manages the 7 hives in the Princess Innengarten and the 2 hives on his balcony at home. So, just how easy is it to become a hobby beekeeper, I wonder?
Well, it's very simple, it's very easy. So if you start with nothing, if you start with zero, then there's not much work to do. You need some tools, a hive tool, for example, you need a veil, and then you can start working with the bees. And
how much would it cost, roughly?
Well, a hive costs around 100 euros, a veil about 15 euros, and a hive tool about 12 euros. So that's not much. You will get along with 200 euros and you can start. You need a little bit more tools for harvest, for example, or to fight some diseases. You need some medicine for them. So 400 euros will do in the first year.
In a factory close to Alexanderplatz in Berlin's very central Mitte district, Annette Müller is busy jarring honey.
When I moved here to Berlin, I was looking for honey from Berlin, and I couldn't find any. And I learned pretty quickly that 80% of the honey in Germany is not from Germany. It's imported, and that not really a lot of supermarkets carry local honey. We are swamped by imported mixtures, which don't have really one origin. It's really a mixture of honeys. It's not one origin, one country.
It was for this reason that she and her partner Jens Michael started their company Berliner Honig in 2010.
Berlin is very, very popular for beekeepers because we have a tremendous amount of trees. We have over 400,000 trees, and 80,000 of those are linden trees. And of course we have in the city more diversity flower-wise than in the countryside.
Each jar of Berliner Honig is stamped with the date, the beekeeper's name, the trees the bees pollinated, and the location of the hive. With over 30 hobby and professional beekeepers supplying them with honey, from Chris and Yela's fruit tree honey to Barbara's spring black locust tree honey from Steinstücken, they offer a variety of different honey types from across the city.
So we are the first organization that entirely focuses on the origin of the honey.
Berliner Honig retails between 5.99 and 7.99 euros. That's well above the cost of other honeys. Despite this, Müller says their business is doing very well, and it's likely to continue that way as long as the number of hobby beekeepers in Berlin continues to grow. Charlotte Lomas, DW Berlin.
Thank you to Charlotte Lomas for that report. We leave the German capital now and head north to the Arctic, where vast reserves of oil and gas lie beneath the rapidly melting ice cover. Now, earlier this week, British energy giant BP became a major shareholder in Rosneft, the Russian state oil company. The deal holds advantages for both partners, but it also has its risks. Here at Living Planet, we're wondering what this means for offshore oil exploration in the Arctic. I'm joined now by reporter Daniela Cheslow, who has spent some time this week talking with the experts about the impact of this deal. Hello, Daniela. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Saroja. Thanks for having me.
Daniela, what can we expect from this new alliance?
Saroja, I spoke to Alexei Bambulyak. He's a Russian environmental auditor who has worked with Arctic developers in Norway and Russia. And he says this is a huge deal economically, but he says we still have a serious challenge in preserving the environment in the Arctic because our knowledge is limited. Here's what he had to say.
And right now, we have the knowledge what they get through economical issues, or price for oil and gas and so on. But it's difficult to understand what we really lose, especially in a long-term perspective, how much we impact the environment.
Bambulyak says we have to do more research, specifically looking at the health of the Arctic and which are the indicators that we can look at to understand the greater picture. So he wants us to find the fish and the plankton that will tell us the greater story about the state of the Arctic Ocean.
But you can't talk about BP without thinking about the huge oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, a big black stain on BP's reputation. What do the experts have to say about trusting BP again? I mean, what kind of partner are they going to be as they enter into this sensitive, sensitive ecosystem?
Well, that's an important question with BP, and Bambulyak thought that actually the spill taught the company a lot about disaster management, which is really important because we don't yet know what a disaster in the offshore drilling of the Arctic might look like. He says that having BP on board would add another level of environmental awareness because BP has their own reputation to clean up.
Now, Bambulyak says we need to know more before we start drilling. And you've been speaking to other experts this week. Did they agree with his point?
Well, actually, they weren't in agreement with him. I spoke to John Farrell, a marine geologist and the executive director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. He says as much as 13% of the world's remaining oil is in the Arctic, and that we may know enough already to go and get it.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Do we really know what the baseline ecosystem is? And then so therefore, do we know if there's been any impacts to it by natural resource development? Well, interestingly to me, when the Deepwater Horizon event occurred, I heard the same thing that, gee, we don't know the baseline. It's like, how come we don't know the baseline in the Gulf of Mexico where we've had researchers for decades? The other big issue in the Arctic is that the ecosystem is changing rapidly now. I mean, with the diminishment of the Arctic sea ice extent and the warming up there is no baseline ecosystem anymore, I would argue. I'd argue that the ecosystem is evolving rapidly right now.
Something interesting that Farrell told me is that the environmental conditions of the Arctic can make it hard to drill safely and to clean up oil spills if they happen.
Cleanup of oil out of the ocean environment is a challenge anywhere, but it's particularly acute in the Arctic environment where, because of ice, because of winds, because of cold conditions, and extreme environments, it's all the more challenging to try to address and respond to an oil spill in ice-covered waters.
Now, global warming has had a profound effect on the Arctic, and it's warming faster than other parts of the planet. So as we're seeing here, it's creating an economic and a political competition. It's almost as if global warming is creating opportunities. What do you have to say about that?
Well, it's true that global warming is making it easier to look for the oil, but it's the burning of that very oil that's also advancing global warming. And John Farrell told me that he experienced this firsthand because he actually went out into the Arctic on an icebreaker to do some research. And he said that along with stunning sunrises over endless stretches of white, he also saw really disturbing visual melting of the polar ice cover. Here he is.
It was almost eerie how much open water we saw because of the massive retreat of ice. We were at 80 degrees north, and traditionally that area has had a good amount of ice. And in this year, at times, we saw no ice at all. In open water, it looked like you might as well be in the North Pacific somewhere.
Either way, both scientists agree that oil exploration in the far reaches of the Arctic isn't going to start immediately. It's still expensive, and with development of shale gas and shale oil in other places of the world, the demand for it has grown lower. But this deal between Rosneft and BP definitely brings British expertise to a major potential new oil source.
Daniela Cheslow is a reporter with us here at DW. Thanks for joining us today, Daniela.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. If you're interested in articles and videos about the environment, you can find us at dw.de/environment. You can also find links to the Grow Green India project mentioned at the top of the show. I hope you'll join us again next week. Until then, I'm Saroja Coelho. This has been Living Planet. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Dem soll